Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello, I'm Sian Kane, and this is the Guardian's Books Podcast. On this week's show, we're talking about one of the world's most easily solved mysteries, why crime fiction is so loved, having finally become the best-selling genre in the UK. And later, we'll be joined in the studio by Aminata Fauna, the award-winning author of The Memory of Love, to talk about her latest book, Happiness. But first, it was announced recently that crime fiction is now the biggest-selling genre in the UK, increasing 19% since 2015 to sell 18.7 million books in 2017, compared to 18.1 million for general and literary fiction. Claire, we've just run a survey of some of the biggest crime writers working today to see what their favourite whodunits are. Do you care to take a stab yourself?
Oh, well, if you're asking me what my favourites are, I have to look back to all those summer holidays when I took away Easy Rawlins mysteries from Walter Mosley. And you know, there are 14 of them starting in 1990. And it strikes me that that's one of the reasons why this is such an incredibly and enduringly popular genre, is you have these fabulous characters who continue through several novels. So they become like your friends, with all their faults. They're usually very flawed, obviously.
Well, I feel like exactly like that with Philip Marlowe, because I love Raymond Chandler, but none of his other sort of books or his short stories have ever worked as well for me as Philip Marlowe. That character is just so wonderful.
And he was chosen in our roundup of crime writers, or we had a bit of a problem over whether they were crime or thrillers or both.
Yeah.
But Benjamin Black, who is also known as Booker winning John Banville, chose The Long Goodbye.
Yes.
And he made a really interesting point that a fellow novelist had made the point, which Benjamin Black thought was actually right, that Chandler's aim in The Long Goodbye was to recast the Great Gatsby in noir mode. And why I find that fascinating is because all the writers that we canvass, they don't see themselves as belonging to a genre at all. They see themselves as belonging to a great literary tradition. And their models go way outside what we would think of as genre fiction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the interesting thing, that I think a lot of what would, in its time when it was contemporary, would have been regarded as a thriller or a crime novel is sort of co-opted into being literary because it's a classic, you know. So things like Du Maurier's Rebecca, which was nominated by S.J. Watson, and Graham McRae Burnett, who nominated Crime and Punishment, which I think is a really, really good choice and a really obvious choice, but also quite a strange one.
He says its fascination lies in the exploration of the machinations of the mind of a killer. Well,
it's not wrong.
It's not wrong. And also talks about it asking big questions, which I think best crime and thrillers do ask big questions: guilt, free will and redemption. And he says that's what makes it not only the greatest crime novel, but perhaps the greatest of all novels. Mm. And we have quite a few of those sort of claims. Laura Lippman, fascinatingly, chooses Lolita.
Yeah.
And actually, I've actually made a bit of a case for this.
Really?
In a small sort of way in a blog back in the day. And, she says, well, it has kidnapping, murder, and it's important to use this term, rape. It also has multiple allusions to Edgar Allan Poe and even hides an important clue, well, not exactly in plain sight, but in text, of, yes, a purloined letter. So it has all the ingredients.
Yeah. And I suppose then that unreliable narrator as well, which seems to come in and out of quite a few of these as well.
Very much recently it's been the main trope, hasn't it? So what of the other ones? This is the rediscoveries and the people who have encouraged me to go back to my old favourites and look at them in a slightly different way. It's what I love about these things. And Sarah Paretsky, now anybody who doesn't know Sarah Paretsky really hasn't read anything. She is responsible for V.I. Warshawski, the hard-ass American detective. And she chooses a writer called Dorothy B. Hughes, who was a contemporary of Edgar Allan Poe, who lived from 1904 to 1993. And I have to say, I'd never heard of her, and particularly mentions her first thriller, The So Blue Mountain, which was published in 1940. And she says the plot is awkward and contrived, but that actually it established the hallmarks of a really brilliant craftswoman. So I'm off to get that.
Yeah. I mean, I have this problem that, I mean, a lot of the books that were nominated by authors here were older books. And I have this problem with crime fiction in that I love old crime fiction. So I love Dashiell Hammett and I love Raymond Chandler. But I really, really do struggle with modern day crime and thrillers, because there is a scientific element that is now introduced into the sleuthing, which it just gets a little bit too complicated for me. I mean, people always talk about the mobile phone killing novels because you can call your way out of any emergency. But I have this problem that things like DNA and sort of crime scene analysis and sort of police bureaucracy, I just want a, you know, hard-nosed PI bashing down doors and, you know, snogging dames and that sort of thing. I don't want the sort of... I tried Kathy Reichs. I don't know if you've ever read any Kathy Reichs. I did try her, and the sort of minutiae of the gore in those books put me off so much, because, you know, scientific level descriptions of corpses and maggots and, you know, bits being found that I just couldn't deal with, and I sort of got rid of it.
Well, that's the sort of pathology tendency, yeah, isn't it? I think that that's been a bit of a runaway over probably the last decade, and it's getting sort of more gorier and gorier, and more to do with it sort of the larval stages of the various insects that feed on corpses than actually about who done it.
Yeah.
What done it in, yeah, terms of tissue decomposition.
And I do really want to read more crime, like more contemporary crime, but it's that struggle to, I think, find things that suit. I mean, I think the most recent thing I've read was Benjamin Black, aka John Banville, standing in the shoes of Raymond Chandler when he did the most recent Philip Marlowe novel a couple of years back. So I really do feel like there is a gap in my reading.
Well, you should probably start with somebody like Lee Child.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because again, that you've got a whole series. You can start at the beginning, you can start wherever you like, and there's sort of a welfare. And Lee Child's Killing Floor was recommended by Drida Say Mitchell. What other ones have we got? Ah, Mark Billingham, Maltese Falcon. Now that that's going to please you, isn't it?
Yes, it will. It's a very,
because
very good
that is sort of, in a way, that's the key novel, isn't it? In that it is probably the novel, as he says, that started the sort of kickstarted the hard boiled movement.
Yeah, I mean, and also in terms of going back to the big novels that I chose. I mean, it's really interesting what you were saying before about Benjamin Black choosing The Long Goodbye out of all the Philip Marlowe novels, because The Big Sleep is regarded as the one that is the famous one, perhaps because of the Humphrey Bogart movie. But The Long Goodbye is really, really interesting, because that one is the last adventure of the Philip Marlowe books. And it was always kind of mocked, I think, because it kind of ends on a really hopeful and positive note, which is not necessarily fitting with the rest of the tone of the series. And it really goes into the romance between Philip Marlowe and a woman, which I think a lot of critics were kind of sniffy about at the time. But I think he's right in saying that it is the one to read, I think, especially if you've loved the others.
Now, you mentioned film, and that's another thing about this particular genre, isn't it? It has such a strong relationship with film. You look at, well, all those Marlowe,
all the Humphrey Bogart movies.
Humphrey Bogart, yeah. I mean, how many people, if you think of Philip Marlowe, you think of Humphrey Bogart,
and even Maltese Falcon as well, you know.
Yeah. And then James Lee Burke recommended Dennis Lehane's Mystic River.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just thinking, well, of all his novels, why would you choose that? And I thought, well, I wondered if part of the reason is that was a Clint Eastwood film, you know?
It got
this whole other life.
And there's also of course, Rebecca and
Gorky Park.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's probably a bit before your time, isn't it?
That was
I remember that film. And that's Jacob Ross. Interestingly, Jacob Ross, who's a really interesting novelist, who's just started his first detective series, which I think, having been published by a very small publisher, is now going to one of the Internationals for the second instalment of it. But he's chosen Martin Cruz Smith's Gorky Park, and you wouldn't necessarily expect him to, because he's very, very immersed in Afro-Caribbean stuff. And the reason he chooses it is he says it... It showed me the possibilities of voice and character attitude in crime writing and how those elements can be brought together to create a truly memorable novel. And so I found that the little insights that these writers give you about the tips they pick up from the greats is fascinating as well.
Well, a lot of them mention character, particularly like Ian Rankin, who chose Bleak House, which is, again, not one that you would expect perhaps to be labelled as crime, but... He says that particularly the cast of characters in that book is remarkable.
It is remarkable, but I've never quite got over Esther Summerson. She's such a drip. But there you go. I've been taken to task for that before. But it is. But he's absolutely right. He says, Ian says, talks about the mazy mystery, a shocking murder, a charismatic police detective, a slippery lawyer, and a plethora of other memorable characters, many of whom are suspects in the crime. Shame about Esther.
Well, Nikki French chose The Moonstone and particularly mentions the villain. And the villain is also often so important in these books, as much as the sort of dashing hero.
And with The Moonstone, we're moving out of crime into thrillers, really, aren't we? And Nikki French says it pretty much invented the thriller form in the way that Dashiell Hammett with The Maltese Falcon invented...
Hard-boiled.
And we had a bit of a discussion about how, when it came to headlining, you know, are these crimes, are they thrillers? Is it crime writers thrillers or thriller writers crime? Or what is the difference? And we always come down to the problem of distinguishing between thrillers and crime.
But I suppose, do we have to?
Well, exactly. Do we have to? You could say both belong to a suspense genre in which crimes are being committed, usually.
I'm
slightly hedging my bets here. My Rolodex has got a bit rusty.
You're listening to the Guardian Books podcast. Aminata Fauna burst onto the literary scene back in 2002 with her book The Devil That Danced on the Water, a memoir about her father. Born in Glasgow, Fauna moved at a young age to Sierra Leone, where her father became the Minister of Finance before being imprisoned by his own government and subsequently executed. Her novels, including Ancestor Stones and The Memory of Love, are beloved by readers and critics alike, and now she's back with her fourth, Happiness. The novel opens with a chance meeting between Attila, a Ghanaian psychiatrist, and an American biologist. When Fauna came to the studio to talk to Richard Lee, she began just after that encounter, as Attila sits down to a proper meal.
Despite the late hour, the restaurant was full. Booths lined the walls and in the centre like water lilies, an array of small and large round tables covered in white tablecloths. Attila was shown to a corner booth. The maitre d' pulled the table out a good way to allow him to slide onto the banquette. He said good evening to the people at the next table and picked up the menu to remind himself of the good things on offer. He ordered calves' liver and bacon, because both of these things were hard to come by where he lived, and the potted shrimps, because they too were a rare treat. A carafe of Rioja completed his choices, and as he waited for his meal to arrive, he sipped wine and looked around at the other clientele. With the exception of a couple seated at one of the water lilies, everyone in the restaurant was white. Attila watched the single black couple for a while. They were young and close in conversation. The woman wore a fuchsia dress, the man was in a suit. An anniversary, thought Attila, and looked away. Some minutes later, as Attila was eating brown shrimp, the man walked past Attila's table, and a few minutes later, on his way back from the gents, he passed by again. This time Attila happened to look up and catch his eye. The man nodded, a single dip of the chin. Attila nodded back and returned to his shrimp. The nod was something that was exchanged only in certain places. Moscow, for example. Perth, Prague. Sao Paulo, no. Havana, no. Mumbai, yes. Rome, less and less often. All of Poland. Much of England beyond the M25. Belfast, yes. In London, more rarely, although a nod might be exchanged in certain kinds of establishment. In this restaurant, Attila drew no stares, but it was still a place the nod might occur. Caramel and chocolate pudding. The chocolate sponge dusted with icing sugar. Attila struck the sponge casing with the back of his spoon, and hot caramel poured from within. He might have been tired, but he was not. There was no question of jet lag, for there was no time difference between Accra and London, but he had flown overnight. On the plane, he'd used the time to review the papers for the conference and details of his keynote speech, which, though he'd delivered it often in the past few years, nevertheless required updating. Attila worked while the other passengers slept or watched movies. The same one, it seemed, for on multiple small screens, Attila could see the same handsome actor grapple with the same armed men, race desperately through the same crowds and streets to defuse the same terrorist's bomb, tirelessly over and over. Attila possessed the gift of being able to choose when and whether to sleep, one that had served him well on various tours of duty, when sleep was impossible, when the environment was too hostile or the victims too many. Out in the field, he would forfeit sleep to work long days, interviewing, assessing, collecting data, and then sleep for a 14-hour stretch back at the hotel. He never waited to return to base to draft his report, but began it then and there, as soon as he woke, and while the thoughts were fresh. Following dinner, when it was by then after midnight, Attila walked briskly back in the direction of the bridge. Exercise and a little air were the things he needed now. Taxis passed him without slowing. The brutal concrete theatre buildings and galleries on the opposite bank were lit blue and red. The plaque was mounted on the balustrade at the apex of the bridge and faced east towards the river estuary. The engraving was worn, the lettering faded, and it had been defaced by a scrawl of graffiti. But the moon was good that night, and Attila bent and traced the skyline with his forefinger. The two new buildings, though, had not yet been added. He turned to walk back the way he'd come. Tonight he would sleep well. In his mind, he was already planning the breakfast he would order in the hotel dining room. When he was away, in the places where he worked, places lost in the moral darkness, London seemed unreal and distant. Even street lighting struck him as an improbable luxury, lights left burning so the population of a city could walk home without fear of injury or crime. When he was in London, going to see plays and eating in fine restaurants, the city itself began to feel like a stage set whose denizens enacted their lives against its magnificent backdrop. A theatre of delights, where nothing surely could go wrong, and if it did, all would be put right by the end of the third act. He stepped up his pace and clapped his hands, as if in anticipation of what lay ahead, but in reality against the cold. On the empty bridge, an animal was trotting towards him, a shifting shape that slid in and out of the light and dark on the bridge. At first, Attila thought it was a cat, and then a dog, until finally the moving shape resolved into the form of a fox. The fox passed Attila by, carving a shallow arc around him, as if merely observing the rules of personal space. Attila walked on, and then stopped and turned around. At the same time, the fox, too, stopped and glanced back over its shoulder and seemed to regard him. Attila pushed his hands into the pockets of his coat. The fox held his gaze, unblinking, for a long moment, then turned and trotted on.
So how did you get started on this story of loss and resilience?
I wrote a book called The Memory of Love, which was published a few years back. And The Memory of Love was set in Sierra Leone, and it was largely, one of the themes was largely trauma. And surviving the trauma of a civil conflict. And in that book, there was a minor character whose name was Attila. And this character, who was only a very small sort of walk-on part, nevertheless stayed with me long after I'd written the book. I wrote another book in between, and I just kept returning to Attila. And what I wanted to do, my plan was, in a reversal of what had happened in The Memory of Love, and actually what happens in so many books and films which are set in Africa, typically written by somebody in the West, where a white man goes to Africa and we see Africa through his gaze. Well, I'd already begun to play with that in The Memory of Love, and I had started to reverse the gaze so that, you know, the main character
looked at the country, but the country also looked back at him and made up its mind about him and his antics. But I decided I wanted to do that more fully. And I kept thinking to myself, well, you know, what if somebody like an African, in this case Ghanaian, Attilus Ghanaian, but what if a psychiatrist from that continent, from that world, came to this world? What would they make of us in the West, of our values, of the way we live, of the way we treat each other? And so that really was the genesis of it, bringing Attila to London.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the connection between those two novels, because you've got Adrian Lockhart, who is a psychologist. In
yes.
Memory of, and Attila, they seem almost as if they're mirror images in some sense.
Yes, yes, they are. So Adrian goes to Sierra Leone and he's a psychologist. Of course, Attila's a psychiatrist, a slight difference there. but he goes there, he can't really understand the country and he can't really understand the people. And the reason is because he has assumed a certain amount of arrogance, which comes partly from his profession, his background, and his cultural heritage. And he thinks that the country's going to explain itself to him. And the country doesn't explain itself to him, right? The people don't all tell him everything he needs to know. And his patients don't all open up. And in fact, only one patient ever really does open up to Adrian Lockhart. But he does make some friends, a young surgeon called Kai, and somewhat less friendly, but nevertheless a kind of caustic paternal figure arises in the form of the psychiatrist who runs the mental hospital where Adrian is doing some of his work, and that is Attila. And between Kai and Attila, they explain to Adrian that really he has to change his way of thinking. He has to open up and to understand the country he's in, and he can't wait for it to explain itself to him. But they do guide him along the way. They guide Adrian towards an understanding.
And how has Attila's thinking developed between the two novels?
Attila was an early specialist in the field of trauma studies, and his great concern was civilian populations. So up until that point, most of the focus of trauma-related interventions were really focused on combatants. So we know about the First World War, that men were first of all shot for cowardice, when they couldn't face the guns, and then people began to realise, people in the medical profession began to realise that this thing called shell shock was a real thing. And over the years, we then get this greater understanding and we begin to call it PTSD. And actually, when I wrote The Memory of Love, I had read a great many novels set in the First World War.
And there was also a rash of them, wasn't there?
Yes, and I had a long standing interest in trauma. And, you know, I had begun to spot this, that all the emphasis was always on the combatants. You know, I mean, I'm thinking of Goodbye to All That. And the emphasis was, and Pat Barker's Regeneration trilogy. But the emphasis, I mean, both popularly in literature and in the medical profession, was really very much on combatants and ex-combatants. And I did begin to think, when I was writing about a civil conflict in Sierra Leone, well, no one's thought about where is the literature on the civilians. So Adrian and Attila were experts in civilian trauma. Attila's thinking has begun to change, as indeed the thinking in the field has begun to change. He's reflecting that, which is that there's a debate within the profession about whether the definition of what is a traumatic experience has gone too far. So we're no longer talking about near-death experiences or the kind of experience you would have in combat. We're now talking about things like divorce. We're talking about the loss of a partner. We're talking about the loss of a job. And a great many psychologists and psychiatrists, those in the mental health professions, are beginning to question this ever-expanding definition and say, are we now pathologizing what really are, should be, experiences we can expect to undergo at some time in our lives? Life is not perfect. Things happen. These are not experiences that result in long-term trauma. We can't pathologize every experience and every emotion attached to those. And I think that that's reflected in a sort of common mood, a popular mood, which is we've really lost sight of the idea that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And we've become overprotective of ourselves. We've developed a fear of adversity, because we think adversity is going to result in pain, and pain equals trauma, and trauma equals damage. And that's how we've begun to treat ourselves and our children.
Yeah, whereas in fact, it's something that it helps you become fully yourself.
That's certainly my view, yes. I mean, I don't know how you become human except in the face of adversity.
It's a novel deeply rooted in London, but your main characters are from elsewhere. Jean is from Greenhampton in Massachusetts, while Attila is from Accra in Ghana. Did your characters need to come from other places so you could put that illusion of security in London to the test?
It struck me that that would need to be the case. Not absolutely everybody. I mean, there is one character, not from London, but from Britain, and that is Rosie. But yes, everybody else comes from elsewhere. Well, it is my experience of London, actually. I think I've only got about four friends who one would call real Londoners. I mean, of course, the definition of what's a real Londoner changes, because London's rather like New York. You come here, you make your home here, and you become a Londoner. But if you're talking about people who were born in London, I've got very few friends who were actually born in London. They all come from somewhere else. Many of them come from elsewhere in Britain, but many of them come from elsewhere in the world too. So it seems to me very, very typical of London, this as a sort of migratory focal point, as many big cities are.
Yeah, there's one of the warmest strands in the book is that some other of the new Londoners, the security guards and doormen from Nigeria and Ghana, traffic wardens from Sierra Leone and the street performer from Bosnia, and the way they come together to help find Tano. Was that partly a question of writing against all the kind of fear of immigration, of people from elsewhere that is so prevalent at the moment?
Well, yes, I don't know who's afraid of immigrants, but they claim to be. I mean, I don't know whether it's fear or just a sort of snippy dislike of difference.
They're certainly painted as bad and wrong and terrible.
Certain papers certainly choose to go that way, yes. And all immigrants, know, as do all people of colour, whether they're immigrants or not, know that, one person commits a crime, everyone becomes responsible for it, which is, of course, exactly the same with the animal world. Foxes, one fox, nips a baby on the ankle, and suddenly we're talking about a fox cull. So, to some extent, yes, there was a pushback, but it also, of all the books that I've written, this one probably reflects my own personal experience more than any other. And not just in London, but elsewhere. When I go to different parts of the world, for example, I've just finished an American book tour, and what I have found over the decade and a half that I've been touring America with my books is whenever I go somewhere where there's a West African population, they always extend an extra kind of kindness or courtesy towards me if they hear my name. And these are people with whom my connection is nothing except a relationship with a very large part of the continent. But if they're Senegalese or Cameroonian or Ghanaian or Nigerian, I mean, generally if they're African, but very much so if they're West African, they'll exchange little courtesies, keeping the hotel restaurant open for me so that I could order food when I came back late after a talk. I'll tell you a funny story. This happened after I'd finished Happiness, in fact. Otherwise, I would have found a way to insert it. But I live in DC now, and a great many of the Uber drivers and taxi drivers are West African. And I had been out with a friend. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was time to go home. He hailed a cab. And I got into the cab, and I started to tell the man my address. And he said, "I know where you live. You are Aminata from Sierra Leone with the Scottish mother. I'm Abu from Senegal. Does your husband know you're out with that man?"
The network had connected you already.
Yes. I think he'd driven us once before and he remembered, you see. He'd taken us, so he remembered my address and the fact I had a husband and asked me about all of it at great length on my way home. I think the thing about cities is they do make these connections. The connections are not blood. The connections are incidental, and one of them might be a shared heritage in some other part of the world. But almost everybody because so few of us are born in London, we've mostly left behind our families. Our families are usually somewhere else, our natal families. So we're making other kinds of connections based on other kinds of things. It might be what you do, it might be where you live. I happen to live in a part of London called Telegraph Hill, where people are very closely bonded together. You know, we're called a created community. And we are, by your newspaper, I think, actually, among others, you know, as a sort of way forward in London. But I think people in cities do form different kinds of communities, and so that was what I wanted to reflect.
Do you think this novel is the fullest expression so far of your project to reverse the gaze that you were talking about earlier?
It certainly is, yes. I mean, I've fully reversed the gaze now by bringing Attila to London, by looking at the city through the lens of him and his experience. And Attila is, you know, kind of a fully integrated person, isn't he? I mean, he knows who he is in the world. He's got ideas. He's extremely intelligent.
Very confident.
Exactly. He's extremely confident, extremely patrician and commanding. So his gaze on London is, in my view, an authoritative one. At least that's what I hope it would be. And so he starts off in the book enjoying the delights of London. And this is something I do. You see, I go off to Sierra Leone, for example. I mean, I travel a lot, but I spend a good bit of time in Sierra Leone. And there you can't even take electricity for granted. It's when you have it as opposed to when you don't, right? We don't call when there's a power cut. We call out when it's on. Right. And then everyone runs around trying to watch TV programs and do the washing. So, you know, so I can come back to London, and after I've been, you know, a few weeks or months in Sierra Leone, I can come back to London and I can play with the light switch, on, off, on, off. You know, the fact that I can just go to a supermarket and get what I want, that restaurants are full of food that comes from all over the world. The theatres, the cinemas. I mean, we have created a wonderland here. And then for Attila, you see, that's what he enjoys out of London. He's never usually here that much. But a couple of things take him out of that comfort zone, that world he's used to of being the professional there to do a professional job, and into another part of London. And so he sees, you know, the flip side of London. He sees London's underbelly.
Do you think that as your project to reverse the gaze continues, do you feel you need to bring audiences in the West with you?
I hope so, yes.
Do you think they're kind of open to that change or looking for it?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hadn't really considered, because I tend to write what I want to write. But I do remember a couple of times getting into discussion with principally English authors about what was the English novel. And the idea that if you were fully English, right, then you... Whatever that means. You couldn't write an English novel. And my reply was, well, a cow... This is not my saying. Somebody much smarter than I said this thousands of years ago. Probably Confucius, I don't know. But anyway, it goes like this. A cow can describe what it feels like to stand in a field eating grass. But a cow cannot tell you what that same cow looks like standing in a field eating grass. So for the reader, I think, for the Western reader, or for the British reader, or for the London reader, that's what I hope I'm giving them. I'm a Londoner. I'm also an outsider. I inhabit both places. And that's... The gaze is both close up and it's long distance. It's looking at London in both different ways.
The population of foxes in London may or may not be on the rise, but there certainly seems to be a wave of foxes in literature, with foxes appearing in recent novels from Helen Oyeyemi, Ned Bowman, Paula Kokotsa, and then in short stories as well from Sarah Hall, Daisy Johnson and others. What do you think it is about the fox that's so appealing for fiction?
Foxes have become more visible. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've grown up with them for so long. For 18 years, I've had the same house in London, and I've watched fox cubs grow up in my garden. And I've kept on wanting to use them in literature in some way, shape or form. I think they're representative, rather like coyotes are, of so much. People attach so many different things to foxes. For some people, they're clever and they're beautiful. And they're elegant creatures that deserve our sympathy and understanding. And for other people, they're villains. So I think they occupy that wonderful space, which coyotes do too. And there's a long... I mean, it isn't... Obviously, you know this, but it isn't just recently writers... You know, it goes right back to, you know, the fairy tales of old. That the predator has this particular hold on the human imagination. And now the predator has moved from beyond to within. The predator walks among us.
It's that intrusion of the wild on what we thought was our territory, do you think?
I think that is certainly a huge part of it. And what it represents to me, what it tells me, because I think, why do people get so wound up about foxes? Right, I mean, really, you know, or even parakeets. Why do people get so wound up? Where I live in Arlington, Virginia, it's deer. Deer are so pleasant. I know they can eat shrubbery, but really, the visceral rage it seems to produce in some people. We had a house in Arlington, the first house we had when we first moved there, and we had a trampoline, you know, set a little bit off the ground for our son. And there was a doe, and she had two fawns, and they used to use it during the day because it gets very hot there. They used to lie under the trampoline. They used it as a sunshade. And I found this perfectly charming, and I could sit on the deck and read a book, and they would be 25, 30 metres away from me, relaxing. They were a little cautious with them. They got used to me. Well, the woman who had the house on the other side, below, didn't like them at all. So she asked me if I could build a wall. And I said, well, no. It's not my house. Right, sorry, it's making me laugh. So absurd, really. She asked me if I could put up a fence. And so I said, it's not my house. You have to ask the owners. So she asked the owners, and they lived overseas, Rwanda, in fact, and fences and deer really were not on the top of their list of priorities. So she put it up herself. Then she asked, but the deer walked around it, you see. What did she think the deer were going to do? They walked around the wall. So she then asked the neighbour on the other side, could they put up a wall? They said no. So she extended the wall in that direction. She asked the neighbours on the other side, could they? No, they said. She did the same thing again. By the time I left, she had about 70 foot of fencing up to stop the deer. Now, you see where I'm going with this, right? You can see the allegory. You know, the world has changed. There are some things you can't control. There are some things that don't need controlling. Right. And every wildlife biologist I spoke to, and one of them who helped me with my research, he said, you know, we start off immediately assuming it's a problem, right? He said, but it's the wrong question. The question isn't how do we deal with the deer problem or the fox problem or indeed the coyote problem. It's, is it a problem? Right? Is it a problem? And it's a problem to some people because, well, everything's a problem to them anyway, but it's a problem to some people because it indicates to them that they are not totally in control of their environment and they're not creatures. You know, the world, the universe is not bent to their will. And I think that really is what underpins it because, you know, the harm that urban wildlife causes is very tiny and negligible. And there are many, many things that cause a great deal more harm. Motor cars for one, dogs for another, cats, you know.
They're vicious creatures, absolutely.
Cats, well, Songbird certainly thinks so.
This is your first novel since the Wyndham Campbell Prize in 2014. Does this substantial award like that, does that change anything about the way you can approach it?
I gave myself every license, but, you know, I mean, my publishers are very good to me. They don't they don't try and control the narrative. They don't tell me to change things.
I'm just wondering if, in a similar way to the foxes or the deer, there's a sense of freedom that a writer gets from that kind of financial security.
The thing is, it buys you time. I mean, that's just the wonderful thing. That's what the Wyndham Campbell Prize is designed to do, and that's what it did do. And so I was really able to spend long periods working on it, long periods thinking about it. And actually, it had a fairly slow turnaround, this book, compared to The Hired Man, which was just 2 years. You know, that was published in 2012, and here we are in 2018. So, I mean, I was doing other things, but essentially I took a much more... a longer-term approach to this book and really spent time immersing myself in those worlds.
And how does that change what's on the page?
Research, you mean?
That breadth of experience, that breadth of time.
That's a good question. I think what it does, I don't think it changes what's... I mean, it doesn't change the shape of the writing. It changes the shape of the thinking. So for me... I'll say this before, but it's worth saying again. Paul Klee, the artist, said that when he drew a picture, he took a line for a walk, right? And I once said, when I write a book, I take a thought for a walk. I think I've taken this thought began way back with The Memory of Love. I mean, maybe even actually with the books before that, it was all forming. And for me, thinking has always been the greater part of writing and the greater part of reading, which is why I read very, very slowly. Which is a bit of a hardship when you do what I do for a living and people expect you to read a lot and you teach as well. But I read slowly because I'm thinking all the time about what it is that the writer is asking me to consider. And that's how I write. I think very hard about what it is I'm asking my readers to contemplate. I mean, there are no answers to the things I write about. They are just things to consider. But I do think, what is the right question to be asking, right? How can I guide all of us towards the thoughts that I want you to contemplate? So I think it's in reflection, really, and moving the story. My stories are guided, they're not plot-driven. I mean, you know, one has to have something of a plot, but they're not plot-driven. They are character-driven, but really they're driven by the thinking of my characters. Where are they arriving with the problems with which they're posed?
That was Aminata Fauna talking to Richard. Happiness is published by Bloomsbury. Next week, we'll be stirring up a witch's brew with Madeline Miller and her mighty feminist reimagining of Greek myth, Circe. In the meantime, you can join in the discussion on Twitter, at Guardian Books, or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us on your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Simon Barnard. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.